This is Chris Bacon, composer for Bates Motel, and you're listening to Good Evening.
Welcome to the Alfred Hitchcock Podcast, available on the Fandom Podcast Network. I am your host today, Brandon Shea Metella, and our other Canadian co-host, Tom Caldwell, is missing in action. I think he has the 40-ounce flu, as we like to say up here. So, you guys know what that is?
I've never heard that in my life.
Yeah, a hangover. He's got the 40-ounce flu.
Oh, okay, that's cool. Oh, fair enough.
That's a Canadian term up here in Canada, eh? Well, so Tom's sick, but we've got Chris, our ever-constant foreign correspondent, joining us today. How are you doing, Chris?
I am doing really well.
And we've got ourselves a wonderful guest, Manish Mathur. Did I say that right?
Mathur.
Manish Mathur. There we go. I got it. I'll say it a couple more times and then I'll have it for sure. And Manish is somebody that I've been dying to get on the podcast because over on the Talk Film Society website, I believe it's just talkfilmsociety.com, Manish writes an article, and he's going through the Alfred Hitchcock films over there. Now, he's not doing them in chronological order. He's just kind of going all over the place. But he's been doing that for quite a few months, about a year now almost, right?
It'll be a year in February.
Mm-hmm. Right on. So before we get started, Manish, tell us why you took this undertaking on about writing these articles for Talk Film Society.
Well, I first started kind of watching Hitchcock films in college, and I had actually taken a course during college, or actually I went to London. It was like a summer course there, and we would like watch a film every day, kind of talk about it, and I really started to like study him and like reading through the Truffaut interviews and other books, and then throughout my like other writing out of school, I would just focus a lot on him. And then when I got hired by Talk Film Society, I pitched the column and I said, you know, you guys don't have anyone talking about Hitchcock. You know, if that's something that you'd want to have on the site regularly, I would love to do that. So, they said yes, and I've been doing it. I haven't gone chronologically for a while. I was sort of doing like the ones you should watch first, and then now I'll try to find like if there's an anniversary coming up or some kind of, you know, way into the film. But mostly it's just pretty random, depending on like which ones I want to watch. But I'm trying to get through some of the more like not so famous ones just so I can save like the good ones for later.
Mm-hmm. And so how long are you going to be taking to do this?
I basically put out two columns a month or two articles a month. So I think like on my list, in my notes of like the ones I have left, I think it should go on for another 6 to 8 months, just depending on how much like more in depth I want to go. Like I haven't really covered his silent films yet, except for The Lodger.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure if I want to.
Well, you better write an article on The Farmer's Wife now.
Yeah, I think I'm going to. It'll be a really short one.
Yeah. So have you discovered a favorite film so far of his? Like, is it the same as prior to studying Hitchcock? Like, did you have a favorite film of his first,
well,
then you discovered him?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because when I was first going through it, like, when I was, like, 20 or 21, I kind of just wanted, like, really like Vertigo. And I was like, oh, it's my favorite Hitchcock film. And then as I started reading more, I started discovering that other people also thought it was his best film. And a couple of years later, it became number one on the Sight and Sound poll. So it feels very cliche now to say Vertigo, but I swear it was my favorite even before I knew that it was so popular. But I think it kind of changes all the time. You know, kind of depending on the last one I watch, or, you know, like sometimes I lean towards Strangers on a Train. Sometimes I lean more towards, Notorious or Frenzy. Just kind of depends on my mood.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Right on. So if you were such a big fan of Vertigo, then how did you feel about Lady Gaga using the Vertigo music in her video for, I think it was Born This Way?
Yeah. I'm all for it. I mean, if more people are discovering him through whatever means, then, you know, I was kind of like going through like old clips on YouTube and someone saying, oh, Lady Gaga brought me here, or so-and-so brought me here. So, and I'm a fan of Lady Gaga. So she seems to be, she's kind of like Madonna, and I think she kind of understands like the, like the cultural context behind it. Like, I don't think she's just like picking it because she likes it. I think she, at least from what I can tell of her, from her interviews, things like that, it seems like she's studying enough about it so that she's using it purposefully, not just randomly.
She's being respectful when she's being referential. She's right. She's not just being like, I'm going to pick this random thing because it looks nice, or I'm going to pick this. It does all tie into what she's talking about and that sort of thing. Yeah, no, I totally agree.
Well, my experience with Lady Gaga, my friend told me, he's like, you have to buy this album. It was her first album. He's like, this is the greatest thing ever. So I bought it and I texted him. I said, you owe me $10.
Oh, that's harsh. Is it true, perhaps, but harsh?
A bit.
Anyways, we should probably move on. We're not here to talk about Lady Gaga today. Maybe some future day.
Well, you know, to be fair, her biggest hit is, it has so many Hitchcock references in it. So, you know.
Which one's that?
Bad Romance.
Bad Romance?
Oh, God, what is it? It's a part of the verse. It's like, I want your psycho, your vertigo stick. Want you in my rear window, baby, you're sick. So she does have like a little, like, propensity for.
Well, then maybe we need to get Lady Gaga on here. Why are we going for shop?
We will ring her up.
Here.
Damn it!
Lady Gaga.
just get into her direct messages.
And I'll just be like,
see what I can do.
Just be like, hi, I know you're really busy at the moment, but do you fancy coming on and talk about Hitchcock? XOXO.
I'll leave that up to you, Chris.
Oh my God! Right. Okay. Fair enough.
Excellent. Well, until we get Lady Gaga, I'm more than thrilled to have Manish on today. So
yeah.
we'll jump into our discussion on The Farmer's Wife. And as far as the summary for the film goes, it's pretty simple. This man is the owner of a farm. He's a relatively well-off man, and his daughter gets married after his wife dies. And once his daughter leaves, he decides that he's kind of lonely in his house, so he figures he's going to get married. His maid at his house, I guess, decides to make a list with him of four people. He goes from one to the next, asking them to marry him. They all laugh him off, and then he finds that his maid loved him the whole time, I guess, and decides to marry her instead. And everybody lived happily ever after. Is that a fairly accurate summary?
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, you've also described the plot of the film Nanny McPhee, but yeah. Hey.
Is Nanny McPhee a remake?
No, well, I've no idea what it is. It's this weird British-American film series with Emma Thompson, and it's mad. But that is basically the plot, which is that, you know, wife dies, he decides he needs... Oh, due to family pressures, it's like, oh, you need a wife. You know, loads of unsuitable people, and it turns out that his maid loved him all along, and so they marry, and it's like a thing. Yeah. I think there's a lot to unpack from this film. Not necessarily in a bad way. I mean, out of all the ones we've reviewed so far, it had the plot that I've enjoyed the most. It will not be one of my favourites because I know which ones we've got coming up and I'm like, yep, these are fantastic, all that sort of thing. But it's not bad. It's just not great.
Right.
I can't hate it as much as I've actively loathed some of the films we've watched.
Downhill was a tough one. Well, before we get too deep into it, let's jump into the history here. I got some notes here for you guys on the production history of the film. So The Farmer's Wife was released in 1928, and it's a silent romantic comedy film directed by Hitchcock. It's adapted from a play of the same name by British novelist, poet, and playwright Eden Philpotts, who's best known for a series of novels based on Dartmoor in Devon. The huge success of the stage play meant that a film version was almost inevitable, and speculation in the press as to who would direct the screen adaptation was ended when it was announced at the start of 1927 that Hitchcock would make the film for British International Pictures. Now, following Downhill and Easy Virtue, this was the third and final play-based adaptation by Elliot Stannard for Hitchcock. Now, again, we're going through these in the date listing of release date on Wikipedia. That's the dates that we've chosen. They may have been made in different order, but this is the order that we're choosing. So we haven't covered Easy Virtue yet, but this is the last adaptation that Elliot Stannard did. Now, production began in October of 27 with extensive location shooting in Devon, Somerset, and Surrey countrysides. It was released on March 2nd, 1928, and it was the first of three Hitchcock films released that year. Most references state that, well, Easy Virtue was completed prior to this. However, again, we are continuing on with our theatrical release order. Hitchcock actually photographed most of the film, as his regular cinematographer, Jack Cox, was ill for most of the shooting. And one of the scenes shows a fascinating Hitchcock stamp in that it was beginning with a slow passage of time and showing the passage of time by indicating how many times the master's laundry is put out to dry. Now, in the book, The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, 50 Years of Motion Pictures, by Donald Spotto, Spotto describes the film as a routine assignment during his contract years at British International Pictures. The film stars Jameson Thomas as Samuel Sweetland. Now, he was an English film actor who appeared in 82 films between 1923 and 1939. He made his screen debut in a film called Choo Chin Chow, which was released in 1923, and in 1929 he starred in Piccadilly as Valentine Wilmot opposite Anna May Wong. At the time, Piccadilly was not well received, but has since been recognized as an accomplished melodrama and is one of the best films of the late British silent era. Lillian Hall Davis, we spoke about when we did our episode on The Ring, but this will be her final appearance in a Hitchcock film. And Gordon Harker, we also covered during our episode of The Ring, but he will return twice more for Champagne and L Street Calling. In 1936, Hitchcock had a book that he wrote called My Screen Memories, and he wrote this of the lead actors. Incidentally, it has always seemed to me to be a waste of Harker's talents that he should almost invariably be cast as a Cockney. He's a brilliant character actor, and perhaps you'll remember that I gave him the role of a Devon farmhand in The Farmer's Wife. He made a very good job of it. This was, in certain respects, a tragic film, for tragedy came to two of the leading players in it. The star of the picture was Jameson Thomas. He had, of course, been in numerous films before this, and he was undoubtedly one of England's most popular players. He is in Hollywood today, playing supporting roles. He left England to take his wife to California. She was very ill. The Californian sunshine seemed to offer the only hopes of a cure, so Jimmy Thomas packed up everything in this country and moved to Hollywood in vain. His wife died in spite of the sacrifice. Thomas's leading lady in The Farmer's Wife was Lillian Hall Davis. She was an amazing girl. On the set, she suffered from acute self-consciousness. She had an acute inferiority complex in regard to her ability to play certain parts. And I remember that she turned down an extremely good role because she wasn't sure she could do it well enough. Actually, she could have played it with ease. So that again came from Hitchcock's My Screen Memories, which was released in 1936. And as part of the Save the Hitchcock 9 campaign started in 2010, the British Film Institute undertook a full restoration of The Farmer's Wife. The original camera negatives no longer exist, and acetate duplicate positives were made in the 60s from the negatives are now the earliest generation sources. So most of these comments were taken from the Hitchcock Zone and from the Wikipedia page on the film. Excellent. Well, why don't we jump in with our first initial comments on the film? Manish, do you want to start us off?
Sure. I like the film. I mean, I thought it was a really fun little story. We've seen so many films like this with the idea, like, someone trying to find a match, and then, like, the one that they actually end up with is, like, the one that was there the whole time. So, I kind of thought that the movie was a little more predictable, but I guess that's just like me having seen so many films since, I mean, this movie came out almost 90 years ago.
Right.
So I guess it's a little, maybe it wasn't so predictable back then, but yeah, I thought it was charming at times. You know, I thought some of the characters were pretty funny. Like the, I guess the groundskeeper or the handyman or whoever. I thought he was pretty funny. I thought that, you know, it was a kind of a light movie. There were some kind of Hitchcockian touches. You know, you could sort of see him kind of flex some of his more creative muscles. But on the whole, I just didn't find it to be very compelling as a whole. Didn't really... It kind of makes sense that it might have been like a contract assignment because it didn't seem like Hitchcock was that interested in it.
Mm-hmm. Did you catch at any time, like it was about a half an hour left in the film when I finally caught that this maid of his had feelings for him? Did I miss something early on or was it really that far into the film before you caught it?
Well, I had just kind of guessed just by like having, like I said, like having seen films like this before, but
okay.
I don't think it was really made clear in the film until, yeah, about 90, 100 minutes in.
Chris?
No, yeah, I agree in that you can sort of see it coming a little bit, but in terms of like, is it signposted? Is it kind of foreshadowed or anything? No, they leave it fairly late in the game and it's just like, oh, he's got, you know, Minter's there helping him, you know, with the list mm-hmm. and everything like that. But then there's no even very blatant kind of like, you know, she looks sad or she's like, you know, oh, I wish he'd marry me, you know, anything like that. We don't get anything like that until,
right,
you know, the end of the second act or kind of three quarters way through the film. So it is a bit signposted late, but it does make sense. I mean, in a weird way, because, you know, Manish is totally right in that this is, out of the ones we reviewed so far, and I dare say even in the whole Hitchcock canon, this is one of the lightest films. It's very light, it's very frothy, it's very kind of, you know, lightweight. It could have been reduced. The version I watched was like 100 minutes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Listen, I could not find a good copy of this anywhere.
The one that I watched was 2 hours and 9 minutes long, and it felt like 47 weeks.
Oh, my God.
Same here.
Oh, God, no. I watched one where it was like, here, it's 1 hour and 40, and even then it took me like 3 separate things to get through it, because I was there just like, oh, good God, this is dragging. They could have easily punched it down to like, you know, 1 hour 20 or that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, you know, it is very light, it is very frothy. It is, in a weird way, it's almost very, I don't know if traditional is the word, maybe kind of cookie cutter. It doesn't feel like a Hitchcock film in terms of the plot, because normally Hitchcock, he does little things to subvert what you're expecting. You know, if you think someone's going to be the hero, surprise they're the villain. If you think someone's going to be the villain, surprise they're the victim, or, you know, the hero becomes the victim, or, you know, anything. He's, you know, doing these little sorts of things, but going through the film you sort of knew where it was going to go, and you knew that, oh, okay, so that's not going to work for this, and that's being set up for that, and that sort of thing, which is fine, it's great, it's perfectly serviceable in, you know, in a film and everything, but because it's Hitchcock, you do sort of think, oh, there'll be like a little twist here, even if it's, you know, quite a light-hearted film, which it is, you know, even just a little subversion of something. Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, when we get on to the later in the film, I just have like some dumb notes that I took, which is basically my internal monologue, and it's on stuff like, what the hell was this? And that's basically going, like, Samuel, I'm like, that is such facial hair that I just couldn't really focus on like his mannerisms or anything. I just kept staring at his mutton chops throughout, and I was just like,
for the main guy?
Oh, yeah, yeah, for Samuel, yeah. I was there just like, Samuel, okay. This is a thing.
Well, what Manish said earlier, like, Gordon Harker, who played, like, his I don't know, yard man or whatever you want to call him, like, he was outstanding in this. And when I noticed him in The Ring as well, and he did a really good job in The Ring.
Yeah.
And, like, a lot of the funniest things in this were him and his physical comedy. Right. Like, when he was trying to drink that glass of water and, like, just couldn't get himself to drink the water because he wanted wine. And when he's, you know, trying to steal pieces of those ribs, yeah. you know, and he's like pretending to eat the bread, but he's actually eating all these ribs. And that scene where he's like, that one woman hired him to be like the doorman for her party, and he's all dressed up, but the pants that he's wearing are too big.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And he can't keep the pants on. And that scene when he's trying to move that woman in the wheelchair around, his like pants keep falling down. I'm like, it's some pretty funny physical yeah. comedy. You know, and it was really well done. And so there was some really interesting moments in this film. But yeah, on the whole, like, it just didn't hold up for me. I just didn't really care about the plot line. I'm like, I don't know. Like, with all the recent wave of, like, you know, like the Me Too hashtag and stuff like this, like, just mm-hmm. the way that this guy was talking about women, like, watching this movie at this time where he's like, you know, oh, they were complaining that the one woman is fat, and he's like, oh, I don't mind if she's pillowy soft. And then the other woman's yeah, maybe she'll turn into a feather bed or something like this when they get to a certain age yeah. and all this. And,
yeah, and that really stuck out to me as well.
Like, just some of the comments. You know what? I'm going to bring them up here because I felt terrible.
Yeah.
But I had sent a message to... There was like a Star Trek writer that I'm like, hey, I'm interested in writing a Star Trek book. What do I do? And for some reason, I was trying to send screenshots of these intertitles to you guys, but they accidentally got attached yeah. to her. So completely out of context,
wow.
I just randomly sent these bizarre nice. Things to her. And I'm like, I'm glad she didn't get upset.
For full reference as well to the listeners, Brandon and Tom have been sending these back and forth all week. I genuinely show them to people at work, and I'm like, yeah, no, I'm doing this film for a podcast, and this is the kind of stuff that they're going with. And we generally had a 5-minute discussion of what other meanings there could be for the feather bed comment, which is like, if she's a downy pillow at 30, she might turn into a feather bed at 40. And I'm like, what, she gets comfier? I don't, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So here's the three that I accidentally sent to this author, and I was so embarrassed, right, when they went yeah. through. But just randomly, just out of nowhere, just picture getting these to you randomly. But you know her back view's not a day over 30.
Oh.
Right? So these are the ones that I wanted to send to you guys. I don't mind they pillowy women, so long as they be pillowy in the right places.
Oh, my.
And then a woman that's a pillow at 30 be often a feather bed at 40.
Yeah.
Anyways, so good thing I was able to explain to her who I was trying to actually send them to. But I was I was more than a touch embarrassed.
That is a good thing. It's not great where you just be like, yeah, sorry that I technically
yeah.
just sent you like random obscene things from the 1920s. Sorry about that.
And then, but yeah, and then I made that one tweet of that one screenshot as well, where she's like, so I'm going to bring that up too. Anyways, so let's talk about this for a minute here.
Yeah.
This would have played as normal in 1928.
Mm.
Normal, I get the impression that this would have played as just normal way that people talked in 1928. What do you guys think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it was still part of the culture. In fact, it's stuff that would have played and been like real comedy hits all the way up until, I don't know, the 70s, 80s, you know. It's just the way that the language has evolved.
Yeah. You know?
And it's weird because normally this sort of thing's associated with like, oh, it's, you know, young lads or, you know, young men talking about like, ah, oh, she, you know, she's like this, that sort of thing. But then in this case, you've got it as a widower who, you know, is talking about his prospective bride and everything. And so it's just creepier. Because he's there just being like, oh, you know, I don't care if she's big, I'll, you know, whatever, all that sort of thing. But the whole objectification of women thing, I mean, you know, we've got to think on, in the 20s, it still wasn't, like, great for women at all. You know?
Well, there's that scene, too, where he comes up to the one who's supposed to be the fat girl. Like, she's not, I don't know, like, I'm fatter than this girl is, right? Like, I don't know, like, I'm a pretty big guy myself. But when he goes up to her, and he's trying to be smooth to her, and he's talking to her, and he's like, oh, like a fox, I'm coming for your chicken, or something like this, he says to her, right? And she's like, what? Like, she didn't even understand what he was saying, I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's, he also, when these women are rejecting him, he's getting, like, angry at them too, right? Like, he's angry and upset and embarrassed that these women, and he's just randomly going up to people and asking them if they'll marry him because he thinks that they're good prospects for him.
Yeah,
I was a little confused because I couldn't tell if they were like in the same social circle at all, or if he was just going up to like random women that he had like heard about.
Well, they had been together at some point earlier in the film, so I got the impression that they were a part of the same social circle. They were like, you know, he's kind of a well-off guy. He's got a couple people working for him, and so do these women, right? Like, but they're single women who've got some money, is the impression that I got from watching the film here. So he's like, oh, they're good enough for me because they're in my same social circle and they're single. Therefore, they should want to marry me, I guess. I don't know.
And also, I mean, he didn't really seem like someone who had lost his wife within the last, like, couple months or year. He hardly seemed to even mourn her at all.
He got over her very quickly.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, I guess there's some kind of passage of time there, but even so, it just seemed like he was just really quick to... like, he never even mentioned her, I don't think.
Well, that was her that died at the beginning. She was sick at the very beginning of the film and died. But they could have not had that scene and just had a line of him saying, oh, I'm lonely without a wife. She died X amount of time ago or whatever. But I don't know. Like, I understand it's film, and I think when they're talking about things like the pillowy feathers and stuff, like, it's code in the film, like, because you can't really say anything. Like, you couldn't go up and be like, more cushion for the pushing or whatever, right? Like, you know, but so there's got to be a sense of innuendo to what they're saying in 1928. I don't think it's actually what they would be saying to each other. It is the general tone, maybe, of what 1928 would have been like.
Well, this is also, from a stage play, so there's some kind of theatricality. I mean, this is kind of like a farce, I guess, in some ways, so yeah. Mm-hmm. It is supposed to be a little more heightened. But I didn't really find that funny or that engaging, but I wonder if audiences back then, or if I'd seen this as a play with modern actors, like, if they did a revival of it, you know, I wonder how it would play.
It does feel a bit like sort of like a screwball comedy from the 20s or 30s in the way that it does. There's a lot of, like, you know, miscommunication, there's a lot of comedic elements bouncing around and that sort of thing. And I do agree. I think if we'd have seen it as like a play, and I think a lot of it would feed off the audience's reactions, because when they hear those one-liners of, you know, ah, da 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 da, ba-da-dum-tsh, whatever it is, I think they get such an reaction that it just feeds into it a bit in a way that you don't with a film. You know, I don't know how else to really describe it, but yeah, I completely agree with the whole idea that if we'd have seen it as a play, or if we'd have seen it, you know, in like a different context, it might have been funnier.
Mm-hmm. And I think that I think this film kind of encapsulates my issues with silent cinema in general. I might be a bad cinephile, but I don't like silent film. I mean, I can appreciate sort of the ones like Modern Times or The Lodger or even The Artist, where there's some kind of inventive filmmaking there. But with a film like this, which seemed like it was shot with dialogue, and then, I mean, I think most silent films were kind of shot with the dialogue and then there's just no sound. So it just kind of feels like I'm watching a lot of people just kind of walking around a room and talking, and I can't really hear what they're saying or appreciate whatever kind of vocal intonations or cadence they might have in their dialogue delivery. So, you know, I think a play version of this would be a lot easier to enjoy, probably a little more fun to watch, because, you know, you have actors giving, you know, they have comic timing, they have physical comedy, they can say their lines a certain way that makes it more enjoyable. Whereas in silent cinema, I just feel like it's hard to watch these more kind of ordinary farce type films. I mean, I think like The Lodger had a lot of different... You guys covered The Lodger already, right?
Yes, we did. Yeah.
So that film, I think Hitchcock was working within the thriller genre, so he was able to do more inventive, more innovative things. But I feel like with this is just, you know, a very simple story that was translated from the stage to the screen. So it just didn't... I don't know. I just... This movie, I think, just like has all the issues that I have about silent cinema in general.
Mm-hmm. We've mentioned on the show before that we have a hard time with silent cinema as well. And it's a real challenge to watch, especially with the type of movies that we've been brought up on.
Right. And, you know, we're not watching these in a theater. Like, I watched this on my laptop on, like, Amazon Prime. So it was so easy just to drown out the music and just go on Twitter or whatever, read the news. So I found that my attention span was really lacking.
The outfit, I mean, okay. This is my... literally something that I saw in, like, the last 5 minutes when you have, I think her name's Hearn. She's the one who rejected him and then was like, oh, but he's rich, I'll marry him. And she comes back and she discovers that he's going to marry the housekeeper, and she has, like, the weirdest ever hysterical fit I've ever seen. When she's like...
And yeah, she's like waving her arms around.
Oh, I know. It was...
Okay, so in the cut version that you watched then, was that the first time you saw that? Because she did it once, one other time in the movie.
Ooh, I don't know. It was
when she that was a callback to a previous joke. Like, when he originally had asked her out, like, that was her response. She was, like, freaking out, and it drew a bunch of people in, and she was shaking her arms like that.
Right.
And yeah. Right. So it was a callback to that reaction. Which it was a stupid reaction. It was dumb.
I will be honest, I may have missed that. But no, yeah, it was at the end, because I also had to comment just like, because, okay, so the end of it is, you know, Samuel and Minta, and they're like, yay, we're going to get married. And he tells her to put on the dress which his wife has left for her, which I still think is bizarre. That is a weird thing to do. But then she comes down, and dear God help me, if you see this film, the dress looks like some kind of, like, bondage gear. And it's awful. I know. It was probably in the style. It was probably everything. But I was just staring at it, and I was there just like, nope. That doesn't look, like, appropriate for the period. Not when you've got, like, everyone just dressed up in, like, oh, this is, like, 1920s. This is appropriate. And she's there just looking like she's walked out of, like, a Berlin leather bar.
Well, maybe the wife had some plans from beyond the grave.
Oh, my God. Yeah, just like, ah. Maybe she will indulge his... I don't need to think about that. Oh, God. Yeah.
But even mentioning the wife, though, like, this farmer guy, he's like, oh, my wife told me I could marry, but she didn't tell me who.
Yeah, that was a strange line.
I just love it.
So he, like, makes this list of people, and I'm like, well... So, but again, it's just so weird, because he's just like, okay, I'm ready to marry, and it's going to be one of these four women on this list. And there's, like, no interaction with them, really, up to this point. Like, there's no interest from these women at all. He's just like, I'm going to marry one of them, and I'll just go from one to one until right. they say yes. And none of them do. It's just so weird. I don't know. Like, I know that... I don't know. Is this supposed to take place in the 20s, do you think?
I have no idea, in all honesty.
And I can't remember. Were they driving cars? Or
no, he was riding a horse.
Maybe it's a period piece, but I didn't read anything about that.
Okay, yeah, because I didn't get that. Because I know that marriage doesn't mean the same thing to everybody. And I know that the definition of marriage has kind of changed over time.
Right?
And, like, you know, we in North America tend to have this, I want to marry the person I love. I want to marry for love. And there have been times and, you know, there's countries in the world and times in history where it's been like, okay, marriage is just, it's something that happens. It's, you know, sometimes you're uniting countries, sometimes you're uniting houses, sometimes it's uniting families. And I get the impression from this that it's like, okay, I'm a man, so I need to have a wife.
Yeah. No,
it doesn't matter who it is.
To me, although I mean, he had the housekeeper to do all of his cooking and cleaning. He had the handyman to do all the, so I'm not really sure, like, what he really needed a woman there for, aside from, like, the companionship or...
It could be status, to be fair. I mean, you know, Brandon's completely right in that, you know, saying... I mean, the concept of modern marriage is like, oh, something you do for love. That's a fairly recent invention. It's not a big, you know, it's not been like, oh, ever since, you know, people were people, we've been marrying for love and everything. No. Not, it's not been since, like, the, I think it was like mid-1900s, that the concept of, well, mid-1800s to early 1900s, that the concept of marriage as like a romantic venture was really brought about for a lot of people. You know, a lot of it is just like, okay, so if these two families end up joined, it'll mean more money for so-and-so, it'll mean protection for them, it'll mean, you know, and it is effectively like a business, it's a bartering system. And it's a way of kind of securing alliances. So what I did enjoy, and I thought this was, it's an arc we've seen like dozens of times with dozens of heroes in romantic comedies, is you've got the very kind of stuffed upper shirt, you know, I don't describe him, but quite cynical, quite like, well, I've got to have a wife because, you know, and there's nothing romantic about it. It's not like, oh, I want to fall in love again. It's, I need the practical kind of wife to kind of, you know, tell the housekeeper what to do, or to, you know, go keep the status in the village going, you know, or do whatever. And then by the end of it, he's realised that Minta has loved him all along. He's reciprocated that, so he has become a bit more romantic and everything. So I did enjoy that, but that's because I like happy endings. So I do, and let's be honest, there's not always a lot of them with Hitchcock. Sometimes he ends things so bleak that I'll take my happy ending where I can get it. So
right.
Yeah, I was happy for Minta. I was like, you know what, you get it, girl.
Yeah, I know. I was the same. I was like, you do you. Do it well. Yeah. No, it was fine. I mean, I think we've spoken more about the film than it sort of warrants, and that's not being mean about it, but it's very fluffy.
It's a very simple film.
Oh, it is very simple. The actual premise of it is quite weird if you think about it, but if you go with it, it's no more weird than some of the romantic comedies that I have, if not seen, then heard of. Mm-hmm. You know,
I didn't find any information about like whether this was a hit or anything like that. I mean, I don't know.
The play was a big hit.
Yeah, the play was, but was the film? I don't.
All that I got from, I didn't write it down, but I got that it received positive reception because of the, it was a very faithful adaptation of the play.
Oh, that's good.
Right? Okay. That was on the Hitchcock Zone page.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
But yeah, positively received. So, but I mean, it's just funny because while I was watching this, I was really trying to picture the reactions of the audience. Like, especially when that woman was freaking out and waving her arms, I'm like, is this what they thought was funny?
Yeah. I wish she had a spinoff. I mean, I liked her a lot. As ridiculous as she was.
Mm. I don't know. That's about what I got to say. Yeah. Manish, do you have any final thoughts on the film?
Not really. I mean, I think if you're someone who like wants to really deep dive in Hitchcock and kind of see his early work, I mean, you should watch it, but I think it's about maybe like a half hour too long.
Mm. Yeah, I think so too. I mean, this is my first time watching this. Like, a lot of these silent films are a first time watch for me. I actually think, you know what? I think all of these silent films, no, I'd seen The Ring first. So yeah, I think The Ring was the only one that I'd seen before. But other than that, I think they've all been a first time watch. And I'm glad I'm going through them because again, it's like, it's watching somebody's, you know, art develop, their career develop, you know, the way that they do their work develop. Would we have gotten the Hitchcock we know had he not made this movie, right? Like, I mean, he got his start at the BFI. If he had not gotten a start at the BFI, we may not have ended up with Psycho and Vertigo, right? Sure. Because it's a ladder. It's a rung on a ladder for him, you know, and it's just taking him to the next thing. It's a job. I got to do this project. You know, we don't have people in this day and age. Like Tarantino's hit the news right now because he's possibly writing and directing the next Star Trek film.
Yeah.
You know, and Tarantino's like said multiple times, I'm going to make 10 films. You know, like that didn't happen in 1928. They just went from project to project.
Right.
You know, and he at that time he's just like, I just need to put food on my table. And it wasn't until he started to get the projects that he wanted and develop the type of film that he wanted to make that he was able to pick and choose the stories that he wanted to tell. You know, so.
But that's all creative grind, isn't it? That is, the heart of it in that no one, you know, maybe some people, but no one really starts out doing exactly the kind of projects they want to do at the success level that they want them to be at. So it's just it's how it goes. So, you know, you sometimes appear in something, or you write something, or you create something, and you're like, oh, okay, either it's from the heart and it doesn't do really well, which is, that is totally fine, or you do something and you're like, well, do you know, I don't really, it's not where my heart is, but it's useful experience, and it kind of gets my foot in the door and all that sort of thing. So yeah, I mean, that's his path has kind of followed what a lot of creatives go through in order to actually get projects off the ground and everything. You know, the vast majority of directors, you know, yeah, they leave, you know, film school or university or whatever it is, but they don't immediately then jump and get approached by Universal to do a, you know, $100 million feature film about their favourite superhero.
Right.
It'll be short films, it'll be, you know, independent films, it'll be kind of building the way up, you know. And I mean, fortunately, more and more directors are being given the chance to make films that kind of align with their vision, but for bigger properties. So there was Kong Skull Island at the start of this year, which was done by, I think it's Jordan Voight Roberts, who'd done one small film, and then someone at Universal had seen it and gone, yeah, this guy's good, we'll give him a try on the Kong, and it was a really good film. Same thing happened with Patty Jenkins, who famously made the excellent Wonder Woman this year, but her only film prior to that had been Monster. Which was a very small independent film, which happened to win Oscar and get a lot of buzz. So it's two different ways of going about it. But
is that all she's done? Is those two movies?
Well, she's done a lot of television. Like, she worked on.
Those are her two films. She hasn't just had like a 20, like a 15.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm like, because Monster's amazing, and I'm like, is that the last film she's directed?
Yeah. Oh, Wonder Woman. Yeah.
Wow. I haven't seen Wonder Woman. I've got no interest in seeing it because I just don't care about superhero films. But I mean, Monster was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, she tried to get. She was supposed to do the Thor sequel, Dark World, but she left the project because she couldn't like work well. Or I think it's more like Marvel just didn't listen to her.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm gonna say it seems like a creative differences sort of thing, because I remember reading that Natalie Portman was pissed off because she wanted Patty Jenkins for the project. Or she was really excited that, we're going to get Patty Jenkins on everything. And then they dropped it for Alan Taylor, who I think he did like a bunch of really good Game of Thrones episodes. And then he got, his first feature was the Thor sequel. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Sorry, yeah.
I mean, you can't
the
get
more
to...
You know.
Well, I mean, David Fincher is one of my favorite directors. And I mean, would we have gotten, you know,
Zodiac,
all the movies that he did without Alien 3, right? So,
who knows?
Although I love Alien 3, it's got a special place in my heart. So, excellent, right on. Well, thanks everybody for joining us today. For those that are listening, if you want to follow along, our next film that we'll be covering in our Hitchcock series is Easy Virtue, as we've heard about so many times. We've got three silent films left. So, Easy Virtue, Champagne, and The Manxman. We're almost done his silent era. And Manish, thank you so much for joining us today. It's great to have you on, you're welcome back anytime you want.
Yeah, I was going to say, I hope you guys have me back for a more like exciting film, like in the 40s or 50s.
Absolutely.
Although, you know, it was cool to watch this film. I mean, I didn't really enjoy it that much, but it was kind of nice to at least like do something I'd never seen or heard about before. So.
Why don't you tell the listeners where they can find you online?
Sure. You can follow me on Twitter at TheManish89. That's TheManish89. You can find my writing at TalkFilmSociety.com, where I do my column, Beginner's Guide to Alfred Hitchcock. And I also write about different films. You know, right now we're working on our like holiday theme, so look out for some of more like Christmas themed articles coming up. But yeah, that's where you can find me.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Chris, where can people find you?
People can find me on Twitter at @higher_boy. Apart from Good Evening Alfred Hitchcock podcast, I do North by Nerdwest with one of my best mates, Emma Platt. We do all kinds of random geeky episodes, chatting, basically two best mates just kind of shooting the breeze about a particular topic for about 45 minutes to an hour. It's a lot of fun. Our last big episode was our Halloween special. We took the month of November off just to give ourselves a bit of a break, but we are recording in December, so hopefully there should be a Christmas special and a New Year special coming soon. I also do little bits and pieces for Set the Tape, which is a fantastic podcast run by my friends AJ Black and Owen Hughes, and it's all kinds of geeky, article-y goodness, so you guys really should check that out.
Mm-hmm. And you can find me over on the Trek FM network with the Edge, which is our Star Trek Discovery podcast, as well as Warp 5, which is our Star Trek Enterprise podcast. And yeah, it's been a lot of fun. But this is our last episode for the year, so we'll see you guys next year. So happy New Year, happy holidays,
yeah,
and thank you very much, and good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.